You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education podcast for the issue of the 11th to the 17th of June. I'm Chris Havergal and I'm joined by Deputy Features Editor Paul Jump, reporters Jack Grove and Holly Else, and Editor John Gill. This week, a Times Higher Education study has revealed that as many as one in six UK universities set grant income targets for individual academics. We'll be discussing the growth of this practice and the impact that it has on researchers. New research has found that nearly half of all UK HE institutions have changed how they calculate degree classifications in the past 5 years to ensure that their students don't get lower grades on average than their counterparts at rival institutions. We'll be considering how confidence in academic standards can be ensured in the future. And we'll also be talking about the Athena Swan gender equality mark as it turns 10. We'll be hearing about plans to take it global. First up, the extent to which universities set grant income targets for individual academics has been revealed for the first time. Paul, you've been looking at this. What did you find?
In the background to this is the Stefan Grimm case at Imperial, where he was, it seems, committed suicide after... Perhaps there are other factors as well, but one of the factors seems to have been that he was given this grant income target that he was failing to meet. And of course there have been other universities in the news over the recent years using targets in various ways. Queen Mary is one, King's, Warwick. So I just wanted to find out exactly how many universities use these things. The answer is a bit messy, in short. There's a certain amount of interpretation in grouping people's responses, but I think it's fair to say that of the 90 odd responses that I got, 11 had some kind of individual targets. Now that's often not for all faculties, not for all individuals, even within particular departments. Some of them sort of bill these things as sort of encourage academics being encouraged to attain these amounts rather than being obliged to. And there's certainly nobody that said, all academics must get this much, otherwise they'll be sacked. I mean, there wasn't anything that stuck. Although, of course, Warwick did sack people on the basis of not getting enough grant income recently. But so with all those caveats, borne in mind, you can say that 11 have some kind of individualised targets. Another 5 refused to answer on the grounds that it was commercially sensitive. I think one of those was Warwick. I think, this is just a matter of judgement, but I think it's probably reasonable to assume that a good number of those 5 presumably do have the targets, otherwise why cite the exemption? Yeah, sure. So if you add them in, that gets you up to 16 out of 90, which is about 1 in 6.
Can I just ask a question? What's the difference between disciplines? I mean, presumably, if you're a historian, say, or someone in the arts and humanities, you're not actually going to have grants of the same size available to you as if you're in some of the hard sciences, for example. Have you got any detail on that, how that differs by subject?
Yeah, I mean, basically, in a lot of cases, the only individualised targets that there are within science faculties or science departments. So a lot of institutions just confine it to those. Aberdeen is one that does have sort of expectations for humanities and social science as well. Again, they're not saying that you have to get it, but you're sort of encouraged to, and if you don't, it sort of might manage you to help you get it. There they do have targets for those, but they are lower. They're set at a lower level, considerably lower.
And Paul, you mentioned clearly the Stefan Grimm case. Yeah. Have you sort of been able to speak to academics about what the actual impact of targets like these, what that can be?
We didn't really talk much about mental health, but we did talk about the effects on sort of science itself and scientific output and that kind of thing. I mean, one of the points made by Jenny Pickerel, who's at Sheffield, she pointed out that one effect is that if you're given a specific target, you can end up sort of scrabbling around to reach it, and you end up with potentially lots of small grants from various places and a very sort of messy research program within your lab. You know, Dorothy Bishop at Oxford made the point that if you do end up with quite a lot of projects, you know, that you've signed up to on the basis that you need the money from the grant, you know, potentially you're not in a position to manage those properly, and you end up not writing up the papers that you really ought to have done. So in fact, it's a sort of waste of funders' money.
I think it is worth saying as well that with the inquest into Stefan Grimm's death, although he didn't go into the sort of detail of this side of things in particularly exhaustive detail, I think I'm right in saying that the coroner did state that this was clearly a stressor. I think I'm quoting from the coroner there in his particular situation. So, I mean, I think it's kind of obvious that being set a target like this can have a negative impact, particularly if you're finding it a struggle to fulfil it. The other thing that's interesting to me is it essentially makes these academics self-employed, doesn't it, if they're having to essentially generate their own income?
Well, that was the point that Alice Gast has made, hasn't she, about Imperial, that they're essentially, academics are like sort of small business owners, and they do have to manage their income and outgoings quite carefully.
So. Okay, well, you can find that story on page 6 and 7 of this week's magazine. Next, the future of quality assurance in UK higher education has been hotly debated in recent weeks, and in no area is it more important than in degree standards. Jack, you've had sight of some research which sheds some light in this area.
Yes, this is the report that is due to come out later this month that we have actually seen a copy of, or a draft copy of. And one of the interesting things it talks about is confidence in degree standards, which it says the higher education is quite happy with progressing along the route it has been with the number of people getting 2.1s going up every year, but people outside the sector are quite concerned about it, and they want something to be done about it. Mm. One of the things it highlights is the fact that about half of all institutions in the past 5 years have changed the way they calculate degrees classification. So this might be some universities will take a... Say some universities would disregard the weakest module or weakest 2 modules that a student does. Some people do an average of all marks, and it's been found that lots of universities are sort of seeing that some of their competitors are handing out more 2.1s, so they've changed the way they do their degree algorithm to make sure that their students are also getting 2.1s, and there's a feeling that this is a bit of a... It's sort of making it easier to get a 2.1. And this is part of the reason, possibly, why there is grade inflation in the academy.
Mm. Yeah. Sorry, and to be clear, this is, if I understand rightly, these are findings from the Higher Education Academy, which are included in this sort of wider consultation about the future of the Quality Assurance Agency.
Yes, this is some research done by the Higher Education Academy, and it's going to be included in another report coming out later this month on external examining. And it's basically saying we need to beef up external examining because there's a feeling, well, are degrees comparable between universities? Is a 2.1 at Oxford the same as a 2.1 at Oxford Brookes? And the sector's quite sketchy on whether that is actually the case.
I mean, that's such an old chestnut, isn't it? It's been going around for as long as... As long as we've had 2.1s, probably. I mean, it does bear an interesting question, though. I mean, is it necessarily a bad thing that institutions are trying to hand out similar proportions of the different grade classifications, or could that be seen as an attempt to get to grips with this comparability issue?
Well, that assumes... Well, that... If everyone is sort of chasing, say... If everyone wants to hand out more 2.1s... then that's obviously going to...
Not necessarily more, but the same number as institutions, you know, down the road that presumably have may have a similar level of achievement within the ranks of students, etc., etc. It doesn't seem strange that you should want to hand out the same proportion of 2.1s as the institution down the road if it's got a similar sort of tariff entry
possibly,
level, etc.
Surely the degree and the work assessed within it should be assessed on subject benchmarks, not how many people down the road are getting a similar number of 2-1s. You know, this is a sense that pressure from league tables, pressure from students who are paying tuition fees are rather undermining degree standards.
And has any institution ever fiddled with its algorithm to hand out less good marks?
Well, that's not known. It
would be interesting to know that one, certainly. Okay, well, it doesn't sound like that's a debate which is going to go away anytime soon, but we'll certainly look forward to further developments with that. Also, in this week's magazine, we revealed the results of the THE 2015 Asia University Rankings, where China overtakes Japan as the region's number one country for producing top universities for the first time. There's a special podcast discussing the results elsewhere on this site. And our cover feature this week, we speak to five academics about what they would do differently if they were appointed Vice Chancellor for the day. But finally, Holly, the gender equality mark Athena Swan is 10 years old, and it's expanded a lot over that period, from 10 member institutions to 129 today. I believe you've been looking at the future development of the equality mark.
Yeah, so I've been talking to David Rubain, who's the chief executive at the Equity Challenge Unit that runs Athena Swan, and he told me how the changes in funding system for higher education will affect their organisation going forward. So they next year will be moving to a subscription model for their work in English universities as HEFCE withdrawing their central funding. So we talked about sort of what that will mean for the organisation and the Athena Swan charter mark, which is now, as you said, quite widespread within the sector. And the results of that discussion we're going to be following up in a later edition of the magazine. But one of the interesting things that he mentioned was how the ECU is in discussions with other countries about taking Athena Swan further afield than the UK. Now, the Republic of Ireland universities can apply to the scheme at the moment, but that's as far as it's gone so far. But ECU are in serious discussions now with Australia in terms of rolling out the charter mark there.
It's very interesting, isn't it, the way these various higher education quangos are starting to sort of try and spread their tentacles further afield, presumably mainly to prop up their sort of business model as HEFCE and public funding withdrawn. I know there's been talk about HEFCE even sort of franchising out the REF to other countries, and sort of let's bonfire the quangos, more internationalisation of the quangos to try and find some financial model that will actually support them as things change.
That was David Willetts' idea, of course. That's coming from on high.
They've done the same at the Higher Education Academy. They've got some international members, but I think it's very hard to get enough international members signed up to really pay its way. I think it's quite a hard thing to do.
The other thing that this story comes the day that the internet's gone mad for the risible comments from Sir Tim Hunt as well, who is flying the flag for British flag for equality in a rather less positive sense overseas, but that's by the by, really.
Okay, and just finally on this one, Holly, I mean, we talk about building sort of subscription, encouraging people to subscribe. You raised one issue in the article. Surely if you want to encourage people to subscribe, if actually funding grants and other sources of funding were actually dependent on that. There's one that's done that so far, if I understand rightly, but surely a key to success would be if that was more widely adopted.
Well, yeah, it's a move that's been talked about a lot, but only one funder so far has actually gone as far as to say this is what's going to happen. Now, the target for that to be in place was 2015, which is now, and we haven't really heard anything more about, if that is going to happen this year, and, or if any universities applying for that specific funding from the Department of Health have been turned down on the grounds that they don't have this charter.
Sure. OK, well, all of these stories and more can be found in this week's magazine, and they're also online at www.timeshighereducation.co.uk. You can also join the debate about these articles on Twitter. We're at Times Higher Ed, and you'll also find us on Facebook, Google+, and LinkedIn. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.